Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 636 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about neurotube defects and some associated disorders. Okay? So neurotube defects and some associated disorders. And the thing is, again, I'm going to try to integrate a bunch of things that I think you're going to find to be really helpful for your exams. So the key thing behind the neurotube defect is basically, your neuropores do not close. Your neuropores literally do not close. If they don't close, that's a problem, right? Because if they don't close, then you're going to have a communication between the spinal canal and your amniotic cavity. Those things, they're not supposed to be communicating with each other, right? They're going to start communicating. And that's a problem because there is basically a conduit that exists between those two things. Right? And the thing is, our friends at the MBMEs, they like to test risk factors, as many of you know, right? So like, what are the classic risk factors you think they love to test with regards to neurotube defects on your exams? Well, I'd hope you're saying things like, you know, folate deficiency in mom, right? So, one thing you need to be careful about is not just folate deficiency in mom, but it's folate deficiency in mom before she gets pregnant and during pregnancy. Those two times matter. Right? So the thing is, they can actually give you a benign question on your exams where it's a woman that is trying to get pregnant, right? And then they ask you which of the following preventive medicine recommendations is most appropriate at this time. Or they can say which of the following is the most appropriate next best step in management. You'd want to go ahead and pick the answer that talks about folate supplementation, right? That person needs folate supplementation, right? So getting folate before you get pregnant, before you have conception, and folate while the conception has happened, that's actually helpful for reducing that risk. But also, if a mom has diabetes, right? So like blood sugar control can also be helpful in reducing the risk of these neurotube defects, right? Now, what are some classic labs you're going to see on your exams in people that have neurotube defects? Well, there are two key ones, right? So there is the one you're going to screen with, and then there's the one you're going to confirm with, right? So the screening is going to be to check the maternal serum AFP. Right? The maternal serum AFP is going to be elevated. So the AFP is going to be elevated in the amniotic fluid and is also going to be elevated in mom's serum, right? Because remember, if the neuropore is open, then alpha fetal protein can flow out into the amniotic fluid and then through the placenta, it can travel because remember the placenta does things back and forth with mom's bloodstream, right? So you're going to see increased AFP in the amniotic fluid and in mom's serum, right? That's like a good screening lab. Although you want to be very careful. If a person has spina bifida occulta, as you're going to see when I talk about it, that's a closed neurotube defect. Okay. In fact, another name you may see on your exams, because I was actually going over this with people in a class yesterday. I was explaining that, hey, the USMLE is one thing they love to do is to use alternate names for things that you know. Right. Just to kind of throw you off a little bit. Right. So one alternate name you may see on your exams for spinal bifida occulta is closed neurotube defect. Closed neurotube defect, right? It's completely closed by skin and soft tissue, right? So there is no communication between the spinal canal and the person's amniotic cavity, right? So the AFP, the alpha fetal protein, is completely normal in a person that has spinal bifida occulta. That's probably like the most benign, the chillest form of a neurotube defect, if there is something like that. Okay, so alpha fetal protein elevated in the amniotic fluid or in maternal serum, you're going to see that with these neurotube defects. Now, another thing I also want to mention is, hey, how can you confirm? Because the truth is there's many things that can raise AFP, right? AFP can be raised. In fact, what is the most common cause of an increased maternal serum AFP? Very high yield. The most common cause of an increased maternal serum AFP is incorrect dating, right? So incorrect dating, right? So the thing is you can use the levels of acetylcholinesterase in the amniotic fluid to confirm the diagnosis of the neurotube defect. Right? Because remember, acetylcholinesterase is an enzyme that is ubiquitous in the nervous system, right? So if the neuropores are open, then that acetylcholinesterase that's in the CSF, in the cerebrospinal fluid, is going to flow out into the amniotic fluid and you're going to find it there. So that's a very good way to confirm that diagnosis, right? So again, they can ask you, hey, between AFP and amniotic fluid AFP and amniotic fluid acetylcholinesterase, which one has a higher positive predictive value for diagnosing a neural tube defect. You want to pick the answer choice. Again, this is a biostats integration. You want to pick the answer choice that talks about you want to pick the answer choice that talks about the acetylcholinesterase. Because, I mean, think about it. It's not only neural tube defects that raise AFP, as I've said, right? You can have an increase in AFP from a body wall defect, right? So say, for example, if a child, if a fetus has a gastroschisis, that can actually cause an increase in AFP, right? And also, some of these genetic abnormalities can cause an increase in AFP. And I guess just as an integration, just think of this as a bonus. But some other things that can raise AFP, right? Don't forget, hepatocellular carcinoma can raise AFP. An endodermal sinus tumor, which sometimes is called a yolk sac tumor, can also raise your AFP, right? And also, there are people that have Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. There's this mass known as a hepatoblastoma. Hepatoblastomas also can raise your serum AFP. Something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams. All right. Something you want to keep at the back of your mind for your exams. All right. So now let's start talking about the neural tube defects. Right. So the first one, again, the benign one is going to be spina bifida occulta. Right. Again, remember, like I said, another name for spina bifida occulta on your exams is a closed neural tube defect. Closed neural tube defect. Right. So what happens here? Well, basically, the caudal neuropore fails to close. Right. If it doesn't close, it fails to close, but there is no herniation. Right, so your spinal cord, your Milo does not herniate, and your meninges, right, like your dura, your arachno, your pia does not herniate. There is literally no herniation. The dura is completely intact, right? And sometimes they can give you a question like this and ask, "Oh, which of the following will be most likely seen on a physical exam?" Well, I'd really hope you're picking the answer that says that you see like a skin dimple, or you can see a tuft of hair, a skin dimple or a tuft of hair. And then let's go to the next one, the one that is next most severe. So the least severe is going to be spina bifida occulta. The next most severe is going to be a meningocele. Okay, meningocele, right? And again, if they ask you which of the following will be found on physical examination in a person with a meningocele, you may see like a fluid-filled mass on the child's lower back, a fluid-filled mass. And what is an alternate name our friends at the MBMEs may use for meningocele? Well, they may call this spina bifida cystica, spina bifida cystica, right? So this is called a meningocele. So the only thing that herniates are your meninges, right? Your meninges only will be the things that will herniate, right? So many times these kids can have bladder bowel dysfunction. They can have like, you know, paralysis of their lower extremities. You know, they can have a series of problems, right? But again, typically it's just the meninges that herniate, right? Now, one thing I want to say, just in terms of epidemiology that is very high yield to know for your exams, is that a meningocele is less common than a myelomeningocele. I'm going to say that again. A meningocele is less common than a myelomeningocele. The myelomeningocele, obviously, is the next one, is the worst of the bunch, right? And basically here, so look at the name, myelomeningocele, right? So your myelo herniates. So your spinal cord herniates. But in addition to your spinal cord herniating, your meninges also going to herniate as well. Your dura, your arachnoid, and your pia. Okay? And it is super high yield to know that, yeah, many of these kids are going to have bowel bladder dysfunction. They can have like saddle anesthesia. They can have like bilateral lower extremity paralysis. They can have like urinary retention. So these kids may need like they may need like chronic catheterization and things like that. Now, one super high yield association to know with myelomeningocele, especially a lumbosacral myelomeningocele, is that you can have a Chiari 2 malformation with this. You can have what, a Chiari 2 malformation with this. So what in the world is a Chiari 2 malformation? Well, a Chiari 2 malformation is where you basically have herniation of two structures, right? The tonsils and the vermis of the cerebellum. They both herniate through the foramen magnum, right? That's a classic, that's what happens in a Chiari 2 malformation, All right. Now, let's talk about, and how about Chiari 1? What herniates in Chiari 1? Well, I said in Chiari 1, it's your cerebellar vermis and your tonsils that herniate. But in Chiari 2 is your tonsils and your vermis that herniates. In Chiari 1, it's just your cerebellar tonsils that herniate. Okay, only your cerebellar tonsils that herniate. Many times, if you see a Chiari 1 malformation, those people are going to have like, you know, headaches as adults. You know, they'll have like cerebellar symptoms, so they can have ataxia and things of that nature, right? And then let's talk about the next neural tube defect, right? So we've talked about all the, and by the way, right, meningocele and a myelomeningeal cell may also be called open neural tube defects on your exams. Remember, I said the spina bifida occulta is a closed neural tube defect, but meningeal cell and myelomeningeal cell, those are open neural tube defects, right? And then another thing to know here is anencephaly, right? So we talked about, hey, if your caudal neural pore fails to close, this is what happens, right? The meningeal cells and stuff. Well, if your rostral, the rostral neural pore, the neural pore at the top fails to close, then that's a problem. That's going to cause anencephaly, right? That's going to cause anencephaly, right? Basically, like, the thing that's going to happen is that these kids, they will have like no forebrain. This is obviously not compatible with life, right? And the thing is, since they have no forebrain, a very important component of the forebrain is gone, and that component is the swallowing center, right? Because remember, how do fetuses work? Fetuses, they urinate and then they swallow their urine. They urinate and then they swallow their urine, right? So a lot of what you consider to be amniotic fluid is actually fetal urine, right? So they have to swallow that thing, right? But if they do not swallow it, then that's going to cause a problem, right? That's going to cause a problem. That's literally going to cause a problem, because the amniotic fluid is going to build up, and that's going to cause polyhydramnios. Right? Because you're peeing, but you're not swallowing. Right? You're peeing, but you're not swallowing. Now, just some other defects that are kind of related to this, right? Don't forget holoprosencephaly. In holoprosencephaly, the right and left cerebral hemispheres, they fail to separate. This usually happens around like weeks 5 to 6, right? And typically this is, you know, not from a folate issue. This is more from a sonic hedgehog mutation. This is one of those strange things that you see that they love on step 1 and on step 3, right? So you have like a sonic hedgehog mutation, right? And then because that affects how things kind of move around or localize, right? So if you have a mutation in that process, that can cause issues, right? So many times these kids, they can have cyclopia. They can have like one eye, basically kind of look like cyclops, unfortunately, right? They can have cleft lip, cleft palate, right? And one high yield thing that many resources don't discuss for some reason, but it's very, very high yield to know for your exams in relation to this, is that holoprosencephaly can be associated with people having no swallowing center. The swallowing center does not develop properly, right? So they can also have polyhydramnios, just like we see. They can also have polyhydramnios, just like we see in people that have anencephaly, right? And they can ask you, oh, which of the following will be seen on imaging? Right, obviously, in a child that has holoprosencephaly, you're gonna see a single ventricle. You're gonna see a mono ventricle. You're gonna notice that many things are fused, right? Because things don't separate, right? So their basal ganglia, you know, you should have your left and right basal ganglia right there. Your basal ganglia is fused. Your ventricles are fused. So you're gonna see like a mono ventricle, right? And remember that this has a very, very strong association with fetal alcohol syndrome or trisomy 13. Remember, that's Bateau syndrome. All right, so I think these are the things I really want to talk about today. But again, please review these things. These are one of those things that you either know or you don't know on your exams. If you know it, you're going to get the question right. If you don't know it, you're going to get the question wrong, right? So just know this stuff. I know some people think that this stuff is only for step 1 until it shows up on step 2 and step 3, and you're like, whoa, where did this come from? And one pro tip I think I want to give you is this. I will strongly encourage you to try to look at the imaging findings in these things, right? So try to look at, hey, how does this present on imaging? I think that's a smart thing to try to do in preparing for your exams. Like, you know, just look at MRI examples of these things, right? So if you like the way I teach, you love the way I explain pathophys, you love the way I integrate things, you're going to love my classes. I have a bunch of classes for step 1 all the way to step 3. For step 1 specifically, I have a 25-hour class. It's taking place in the month of May. And then for step 1 all the way to step 3, I have a 2.5-hour test-taking class. I have a 4-hour biostatistics class. I have a 5-hour social sciences, quality improvement, healthcare systems, and hospital medicine, ethics, quality improvement class. That's for step 1, 2, 3. And then with regards to step 2 specifically, I have a last minute review that's 3 hours long. I have a 20-hour class, and then I have a 50-hour class. The 50-hour class takes place in the month of June. That's the only time it's going to hold this year. Very, very limited spots available for that. So all these classes are held over Zoom. I am the one that teaches literally all these classes, right? So it's not like some TA teaching. No, it's Divine teaching it over Zoom. And again, these classes are not, hey, come and just learn formulas and associations. No, you're going to come, you're going to learn pathophysiology. And not just pathophysiology, but hey, how do these things present on the exams? And I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams as well, and, you know, shelf exams and med school exams. And then I help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and all those things. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I can give you some more information. Or you can also email me at Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end, Divine Intervention Podcast with an S at the end at gmail.com. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, Spotify. So check those out. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective I address a life lesson. You guys know I'm a Christ follower, so many people actually listen to those. I have almost 400 podcasts on there. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 637. So have a wonderful day. God bless you, and bye for now. Thank you.